You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. We'll leave death row now and hear from an inmate who's been sharing commentaries with KALW about his experience behind prison walls. His name is Richard Gilliam.
As of March 1st, I will have 38 days remaining to serve until my parole date, yet I have not signed my parole conditions, nor do I know the parole office I am to report to, and, most importantly, I have no idea where I'll be staying once I re-enter the community.
Gilliam has written about the arbitrary nature of enforcement of the rules, race relations, and watching a cellmate wait too long for critical health care. And then at the end of March, we got this letter, read by KALW's Chris Hoff.
As a prisoner, I quickly learned the consequences of unauthorized or prohibited behavior. An inmate caught breaking any rule is swiftly penalized. Depending on the gravity of the infraction, he might lose good time credits or privileges such as access to yard or entertainment appliances, or he might be placed in administrative segregation if he is deemed a threat to others. But how does the CDCR acknowledge and address positive behavior by inmates? Does the CDCR reward those prisoners that strive to obey the rules and comport themselves as model prisoners? In theory, it does. If an inmate can stay disciplinary free for long enough, he may be able to transfer to a less restrictive institution, but not always. In short, CDCR personnel give little consideration to prisoners who behave well. And the other day, I personally discovered just how much CDCR personnel value exceptional behavior. I was transferred to CMC West about 2 years ago. After implementation of the state's realignment plan, some of the 90-man dorms here were reduced to 45 men. I was lucky enough to be housed in one of those. Living in a dorm that housed a number of men it was actually designed to handle was like winning the prison lottery. I no longer had to wait in line to shower or shave or sit on a toilet. I could walk the length of the building without bumping into or dodging another man. And it was so much quieter. So correctional personnel were quick to convey the understanding that remaining in this less stressful environment was now a privilege. Break a rule, and there were plenty of people waiting to take that spot. I was okay with that. I think continued good behavior should be rewarded, and that those rewards are spelled out. I also believe that the consequences of unwanted behavior should be just as clear. But here is where reason departs. The other day, my former dorm officer, whom I'll call Officer Rugburn, informed me that he was moving me to another dorm to make room for some other inmate. He did this under the guise of needing to, quote, ethnically balance the dorm's inmate population, but we all understood this to be a ruse in order that he could justify moving inmates around without real cause. The ethnic balance was not so out of kilter that it needed immediate modification. I tried reasoning with him, explaining that I had less than 1 month until I paroled, after which he was free to move anybody he wanted to into the bed I vacated. Of course, he already knew I was disciplinary free, or I would have been removed for a cause already. But Officer Rugburn, as well as the interchangeable sergeant on duty that day, nonetheless decided that my 2 years of positive behavior counted for nothing and moved me anyway. As of today, I have 10 days until I parole. And in the larger scheme of things, it probably won't matter that Officer Rugburn and his ilk didn't give my positive behavior any value whatsoever. But prisoners are people too. How would you feel if your good deeds, hard work, or extra endeavors were dismissed as inconsequential? When positive behavior is ignored in the prison setting, then what is the point of striving to excel? Ignoring positive behavior promotes apathy. Why should I try if my efforts are not recognized? This attitude is counterproductive and can and will follow formerly incarcerated individuals into the communities. And apathy in the communities leads to failure. See how a little thing like this can have substantial consequences? It all starts with a little due consideration. And really, is that too much to expect?
That's KALW's Chris Hoff reading a letter by prison inmate Richard Gilliam, who regularly sent us dispatches from behind bars to give us a lens into the 33 prisons housing about 120,000 people in California. And earlier this month, Gilliam was released after serving more than a decade in California's prisons.
It was almost surreal. I mean, going from, you know, a highly regimented environment to sitting on a bus with, you know, everyday citizens who I didn't, you know, interact with very much at all. Like, well, in San Quentin, we did somewhat, but still, that was in the institutional setting. You know, it was almost surreal to see people going about their normal everyday lives, and there was no, you know, neon sign over me that said, "Hey, this is a parolee or ex-felon or something." You know, it's just like they just, you know, I was just another part of society then at that point.
Is that how it felt for you, or did you feel like you had some kind of neon sign over you?
You know, on a realistic basis, you know, I knew I didn't, but, you know, because I'd been treated so differently from everybody else for so long, you know, you almost expect that to be perpetuated, you know?
And did anything surprise you? Was there anything that you didn't expect?
Well, I mean, just in the period of time, not immediately, no. I mean, you know, it seems like the prices of everything have gone up quite a bit. You know, I used to be able to buy a hamburger for a couple bucks, and now they're $5, $6, $7 or something or more, I guess. And actually handling money for the first time in over 10 years was a really, you know, surreal experience. You know, somebody saying, well, you know, I actually had money to give them, you know, which I hadn't carried in a long, long time.
And Richard, where are you now? What's your life like now? You're about 2 weeks out.
Right. Well, what I did after release is if any of your audience may have followed some of my postings, you know, I was trying very hard to get into transitional housing arrangement because, you know, after that length of time, you know, I really didn't have many resources. You know, I don't have a lot of family, and, you know, that situation wasn't viable. You know, and I need to be out, you know, get out on my own and start reintegrating into society as an individual. So, you know, I was able to, after I spoke to my parole officer, I was able to get, you know, a transitional housing situation here in downtown L.A., which is, you know, really lucky for me because otherwise, I don't know what would have happened.
And you wrote to us a lot about the anxieties that you had about release, about really trying for this last year to plan for your reentry into society, to go back to school, to have housing, not to be to be really be a productive member of society. What was that parole process like for you, and what insight do you have into what might work better for inmates?
Yeah, you know, on my end, you know, I tried to do everything that I could to secure transitional housing. I spoke to my correctional caseworker, you know, and asked her to call, you know, numbers of programs that I thought would be a good fit for me, you know, and she said she tried. You know, I have to take her at her word, but she was never able to succeed in actually, you know, securing that. It wasn't until I actually was out of prison and sitting in my parole officer's office that, you know, I expressed an interest in coming to the Weingart Center, which is in downtown L.A., and he picked up the phone and was able to contact him right away and secure the housing I needed.
And, you know, you wrote to us a lot about, in fact, the commentary that we just heard, your last commentary from Behind Bars. You wrote about the arbitrary nature of the rules in prison. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what it's like?
Yeah, that was something that, you know, really got under my skin is the fact that, you know, my individuality, everybody in prison, their individuality is taken away. And that group treatment is just reinforced on every level. It's like, you know, there are rules in prison, but there are also regulations that, you know, the staff has to is supposed to abide by. And one of the things because they didn't want to put in the actual work, in my opinion, that they would end up just punishing everybody for one person's infraction because they maybe couldn't find that one person who broke the rules, you know, somebody that was smoking or, you know, something like that. And then so they would just punish everybody in the area, you know, and that's something that really got under my skin because for the most part I wasn't breaking the rules and I didn't feel that I should be treated so anonymously. You know, I'm an individual. Everybody's an individual. You know, on the one level I understand, you know, you're dealing with a large group of people and you have to have in place policies that deal with a large group of people. But then, you know, on an interpersonal basis, you know, when it comes to individual accountability, I think that, you know, I'm a big believer in that people are accountable for their own actions and I shouldn't be held accountable for somebody else's actions. And it just really, you know, didn't sit well with me at all.
Well, and you also sort of say that you feel like there are penalties for bad behavior, but there's no incentives for good behavior.
Yeah, it seems so. You know, I mean, they're quick to punish, but then there's no praise at all. You know, you'll never hear a prison guard say, "Hey, you did good," or you know, we're going to reward you with, you know, something extra. You know, it just didn't happen that way. And maybe it's the nature of the institution, you know, but I always felt that, you know, you might get a better response if you could actually give positive reinforcement rather than only negative reinforcement to people in that sort of position.
And you're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. We're speaking with Richard Gilliam. He's a former inmate at the California Men's Colony State Prison. He was just released earlier this month. He's been sending us dispatches from behind bars for the last couple of years. And he just got out after 13 years in prison. So I'm wondering, Richard, I think most people in the audience probably don't know this, so I'm going to clue them in. As a journalist, we're not allowed to ask to do an interview with a specific inmate. You can go into prison and do a story on a subject, but you can't ask to speak to a specific inmate. And so this is a rare opportunity for us to hear from somebody who has this experience of being behind bars in California's prison system. Of you that we don't hear very often, and yet these inmates are released into civilian life every single day. So, Richard, I wonder if there's a few things that you'd like people who are listening to understand about prison life and the questions that we're grappling with right now as a society around prison reform.
Right. Well, you know, it says in the penal code that the reason for imprisonment is punishment, and they reinforce that every day, you know. I wholeheartedly believe that, you know, in almost all cases, except for very egregious cases, you know, that everybody's going to get out, you know, and their issues are not really met. You know, some people, there's a lot of mental health issues, mental illness with people that go into prison, and although the Department of Corrections does a really good job of prescribing medications that helped us, you know, you'd be surprised, on a day-to-day basis, guys in prison who, you know, have very little in common and may have actually animosities a lot of times, we function pretty well on a day-to-day basis, you know, except for you hear about the prison riots and things like that, but those are usually sporadic and they don't happen every day. For the most part, on a day-to-day basis, you know, we get along, we function pretty well. And this is people from diverse backgrounds, different ethnicities, you know, the whole specter of humanity. But what they don't do well is, you know, on an individual basis, is address the needs of each person and say, okay, you know, most people in prison don't even possess a high school education, and the Department of Corrections is not mandated to give, well, up until recently they weren't mandated to give them a high school education. They were only mandated to give them up to a ninth grade education, and then they would let them opt out of school. Well, you know, anybody in the real world knows that anybody with a ninth grade education doesn't have a viable chance to get a job out there. You need at the very minimum a GED. And I think that this and more vocational training and more technical training should be available to prisoners while they're in prison. You know, I know there's a lot of people that disagree with that, but I believe that the recidivism rate and the employability of inmates and their ability to reintegrate into society would be greatly enhanced if programs like that were put in place and made available to the larger percentage of prisoners.
And tell us about your plans for your future and your hopes.
Well, like I said, I've already acquired, you know, transitional housing here in a program designed for parolees. You know, it reinforces transition into the community. They utilize a structured environment, you know, a 12-step programs and counseling, and it's a pretty comprehensive program. And then I've also already registered to finish my college education at Santa Monica College. So, you know, those are the steps I've taken at this time. You know, as time goes on, you know, I'll seek employment and, you know, start saving money and do just, you know, the things that everybody else has to do to, you know, to survive out here.
Where do you hope to see yourself in, say, 2 years, Richard?
Well, that's, you know, 2 years is, you know, is a very short time. So, in reality, so, you know, it's hard to say. I may still be here, although I don't know if I'll be able to stay for 2 years. I know you can stay up to a year in this particular program, but they're really good about helping people transition to other kind of housing arrangements that may be long term. And then, you know, I'm going to be. Hopefully, in a couple of years, I'll have attained my AA degree, and I want to continue writing and maybe work in the media somehow, if that's possible.
Well, we hope that you'll stay in touch with us and let us know how it goes as you do re-enter society and hopefully get a college degree.
Well, I plan to do that, Holly.
Great. Well, thanks for talking with us, Richard.
Thank you.